Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast where we review films. Kaboom. My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a critic of absolutely no renown, and with me, as always, is my scintillating co-host, William. Introduce yourself.
My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic, and everybody calls me Bibbs, and if it takes me till the day I die, I will get Whitney to start appreciating his own self-worth at the top of these podcasts. He's a wonderful critic, and I'm honored to review movies with him, and this week, we're reviewing a bunch of new movies. We're reviewing the new releases Black Widow, Fear Street, 1978, Sun, S-O-N, Summertime, S-U-M, and Genus, comma, Pan. That's not two titles with an Oxford comma. That's one title
Genus,
with a comma in it.
Genus, Pan. It's the latest film from Lav Diaz.
Oh, so it must be like 8 hours long.
It is a jaunty 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Whoa!
Yeah, I know. It's practically a short by Lav Diaz standards.
Holy snap. But wow, yeah, that's exciting.
Talking about a brand new Lav Diaz. Well, not brand new, but recently made available in the United States.
No, he's reinvented himself as someone who makes shorts. Yeah, that's a lot of new films. And we're starting to see summer start kind of to feel like summer again. We're getting big blockbusters every single week. At least big, expensive, giant movies that are getting released in every format.
And here in L.A., well, it used to be just here in L.A., but now worldwide, people are getting all the box office reports.
Yes.
And looking at them very carefully in this age of, as theaters sort of reopen post-pandemic, and trying to figure out when it's safe to say that things are back to normal.
Well, I think we're at a point, and this brings us to our first title, where things might never be 100% back to normal, at least the way they were. And this is an interesting case where Disney has decided to release many of their new films. Some of them are being released directly just to Disney Plus, including films that you would think would do well in theaters, like Pixar's Luca. But for a film like Black Widow, which is this, you know, giant installment of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I think it's the most financially successful film franchise of all time at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, certainly incredibly popular.
It's this one and Francis the Talking Mule. That's kind of
those are the two
right at the top,
the pinnacles.
Those mule pictures were very popular.
They weren't this popular. That's not overselling. There was a popular film franchise of the 1950s called Francis the Talking Mule.
But it was popular. It was popular. No, that did not nearly approach anything like Marvel superheroes.
We bring it up to remind people that just because something's popular, like really popular now, doesn't mean that in 50 years anyone's going to care.
Mm-hmm.
nobody talks about Francis anymore. It's dead. But I digress. My point is this. Black Widow was released this last weekend, and it was released in theaters, but it was also released on Disney Plus at a premium. I think it was like $30.
Yeah, which the first time they did this was last year with Mulan.
But
it didn't release in theaters. They decided, let's test it out. Let's see if we can put like a really high price point on it and sell it to streaming. And they didn't release any numbers because they don't have to.
No, they don't.
There's no obligation to release these numbers.
They kind of have to release numbers in theaters because they're working with theaters. They can't hide them.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's all just Disney selling movies from Disney, there's no middleman. They don't have to tell you if it's not good or if it's like they're not necessarily sure if they want to share. But what happened with Black Widow was they decided to share the numbers. Now, theatrically, it did okay. It's still post-pandemic.
Mid-pandemic. We're not out of the woods yet. But
it did pretty good for a pandemic-era movie.
About as good, a little bit better than F9.
Yeah. Which is to say,
in theaters.
Which is to say, like, under $100 million, but did rather well.
Yeah.
But low for an MCU movie, traditionally. However, apparently Disney said you can add another $60 million on top of that just from Disney+, which sets the opening weekend comfortably in the, like, mid-hundreds of millions range, like 140, 150.
So this is either a way for just sort of them to improve their optics. Mm-hmm. This one also made $100 million.
Yeah, the MCU has not taken a drop. I'm sure that's important to them.
Yeah. But also, this kind of reveals, and this is all significant to business. Usually we don't talk about this side of things too much, but Disney is actually making a lot of money through this home streaming service.
Yeah.
And this is sort of proof positive that this hybrid model is the future.
I think so.
They're going to release in theaters and on streaming because, mm-hmm. guess what? They're probably making a lot more money. They're not taking as big a cut from streaming as they are from releasing something in theaters, especially worldwide.
And you got to remember that it is kind of weird because if you think about it, that streaming option for $30... That's a lot of money. That's more money than one movie theater ticket in almost all markets. You know, there might be a few like D-Box or whatever, giant IMAX screenings, you know, prime time might end up costing that much. But generally speaking, that's more than one ticket. So it might not be the best deal for people who don't have a lot of stray cash just floating around. Hmm. However, for families, that's a great bargain. If you normally would take like four people, you, your spouse, your two kids, your dog dressed up as a child... Just wheel it in, have to buy a ticket for it. I don't know how it works.
Wheel it. Why is it on a cart?
I don't know. It's in a carriage. It's a little, you know, perambulator.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm thinking it out. My point is this. I don't have kids. My point is this. You know, you put four or five people buying tickets, you're already at, like, looking at close to, like, around 75 bucks a lot of the time. And then you buy snacks and parking. And it just ends up the Disney Plus model can save a lot of money. So some people might say to themselves, well, that's money they might have lost because they're not buying that many tickets. But again, Disney doesn't see 100% of every ticket sold. Mm. That $30, they get to keep that.
Yeah.
That doesn't go anywhere else.
And if it's just two people, a lot of people could justify that cost. Oh, I'll pay $15 to see something premium if we watch it together.
Yeah.
And they're not, you know, Disney Plus is not cracking down on like shared passwords or anything. So I'm sure there's people proliferating their passwords about and, you know, sharing the profits that way. So it seems like a good deal for audiences at the end of the day. Yeah. It might seem high for a single ticket price, but that's not how people are consuming these.
I guess, and I don't want to get too hung up on box office because I don't think it's important, but I do think it's interesting right now. This is why it's fun to conversation have right now. Well, because things are changing, and I think what's going to need to change is because we're so used to the business model for films being exclusively theatrical. And then, like, you know, there's international markets and home video, but our initial concern is just theatrical.
The opening weekend has become
especially opening weekend.
A big focus of our attention.
The opening weekend, you know, what is successful for an opening weekend changes dramatically when you change the medium in which it is distributed. Mm. So this might be as profitable or close to as profitable for Disney as a normal theatrical release might be because they get to keep so much of that percentage all to themselves. And as a result, while this might not seem like, oh, they made $200 million opening weekend, they did great.
They're doing just fine.
This
idea of having these gigantic opening weekends is kind of a thing of the past now.
Yeah, it's unlikely any movie is gonna get $200 million a weekend anytime in the future.
It's been said that Avengers Endgame was like the last one, like ever in history. And
they might re-release Avatar, they might re-release Titanic, and those three might jockey for number one position once in a while because it's all very, very close. Mm. But seriously, that kind of wide release model. Probably going the way of the dodo.
A lot of theaters closed down. HBO announced their whole slate was going straight to streaming, and Disney announced all of these like Star Wars things that were all straight to streaming.
Yeah,
a bunch of like long form TV shows. Like this model of the film blockbuster is essentially on the wane.
It could change.
I hope to be proven wrong someday.
My
predictions always, well, they don't always suck, but they usually suck. And so this is curious to review this brand new giganto blockbuster in this hybrid model because depending on what medium in which you saw it might affect how you view the film.
Yeah, this is often the case for big spectacle movies.
Yeah.
Where in theaters, they're often treated as something of an amusement park ride. You know, I
want to get a big screen and I want my field of vision to be full with all of this visual information flying off.
But the irony, of course, is that after you see it once or twice in theaters, I guess more if you're a super fan, but usually people only see a movie once or twice.
You know, just once for me, but
I'm just saying, some people, whatever. My point is this. When I was a kid in the summer, I would see movies multiple times.
But, same, yeah. So, summer 96, I saw all of those.
Yeah.
Like, Mission Impossible and Independence Day, I saw multiple times.
Exactly. But my point is this. After that, you're going to see it on home video. Mm. That's it. That's going to be 99.9% of the times that movie's available to you is on home video. And whether that means streaming, Blu-ray, doesn't matter. That's just where the movie's going to live for the majority of history. So it's got to work in that way. Mm. It's got to work on that level. So let's get into it. Black Widow, newest MCU movie, stars Scarlett Johansson. She's the Russian super spy who defected and joined the Avengers. Through a series of kind of shitty machinations, she's never had her own feature film before in the MCU, like all dedicated to herself. And now she finally does, after she already died.
Yeah, she this character, the Black Widow, died, or just Black Widow, died during Avengers Endgame. I was in the bathroom for that scene.
oh my God.
I was able to put it together.
It's a long movie. I guess it's hard to pick a good moment. And it'd be great if they gave you like a little warning, like if you had to go to the bathroom, the next 60 seconds are mostly filler.
Yeah. But the character died. The character has always had a frustratingly off to the side role. I think this is her ninth feature film, like her eighth or ninth. But this is the first time she's had anything significant to display.
Winter Soldier, a little bit, I'd say.
Maybe a little. I feel like I'm going to get in trouble for this one. I think Scarlett Johansson has been miscast in this role.
Mm.
I feel like they've tried to write the character as being a little bit more like flip and energetic, and Scarlett Johansson has played her as very sort of like steely. And it just she hasn't really emerged as a very charismatic figure. She's just sort of like a supporting
I wonder if part of that's because originally it was supposed to be Emily Blunt. And then
that would have been great.
Yeah, Emily Blunt was originally cast, and then this is one of those like when Dougray Scott was supposed to be Wolverine, but Mission Impossible 2 ran over, and he couldn't get out of that commitment, so they had to find Hugh Jackman really fast. And look at how that turned out.
Hugh Jackman was like a nobody, and that like made him a superstar.
Emily Blunt was working on Gulliver's Travels, and that went over, and so she didn't get to be Black Widow. And you're just sort of like, oh wow, of all the movies to, like, get in your way, Gulliver's Travels, which is not a good film. It's not a good Gulliver's Travels. I know that's a hot take, but it's true. So, but in any case, she, you're right. I think it's a role that initially, I think it took them a while to figure out who the Black Widow was, because initially she was, like, undercover as Tony Stark's new assistant, and then she was revealed to be a super spy, and she didn't really get a lot of time in that first movie to, like... Mm. I remember when they actually did the big reveal. I mean, I knew who she was because I read the comics, but when they did the big dramatic reveal that your new assistant is actually this Russian super spy, they did it at that fucking... What's that donut shop over by LAX?
Randy's.
They did it at Randy's Donuts where just...
Doesn't she just drive up and she's in the outfit?
No, she didn't drive up. She walks in. Like, Tony Stark is eaten there with Samuel L. Jackson. They're talking about if Tony Stark is, you know, he's dying and he's you know, drinking himself to death and he's having a rough time of it. And then Scarlett is like, oh, hey, Steve. Hey, Nick. Oh, hey, she was a spy. Okay, bye. Okay, cool. Like, can we at least give it a little bit of weight?
So Black Widow was, I guess, initially not meant to be a bigger part of this, or maybe she was.
I think she was. At the time, she wasn't a huge member of the comics, but, like, I think she was... Scarlett Johansson was not nobody. Scarlett Johansson was a get, so, like...
She was a huge star. So she still is.
I think that first movie, they didn't know what to do with her. I don't think they figured out what to do with her, really, until the 1-2 punch of the first Avengers, which made her a bit more of a central focus, with the whole Hawkeye angle and like her scenes with Loki, and then with Winter Soldier, because
there
are
six of them, and she's one of the six.
And then Winter Soldier, that was a spy movie, essentially. That was Marvel's take on a spy movie in a lot of ways, at least the Tom Clancy-ish one.
This one is the spy movie.
Well, also, I think Winter Soldier was Marvel's like sort of Tom Clancy spy movie, and I think this is Marvel's kind of more of a Bond film. In terms of its like scope, so
globe-trotting, super tech.
So, but I think that one they started to figure out, like, okay, she's a spy. Who is she as a spy? Let's show her actually do spy stuff. And I think that one worked really, really well. And I think we're back to that here. And this one takes place in that sort of pocket between Captain America: Civil War, when Black Widow and a bunch of the other Avengers were basically outlaws and running around the globe trying not to get captured. Some of them already had been. And then the start of Infinity War, when things started sort of coming together. So at the beginning of the movie, she's on the run.
I was a little lost because I had forgotten what happened at the end of Civil War. I knew that there was a big fight between Captain America and Iron Man.
Yeah.
And I know that Sebastian Stan had been spirited off to like a safe house somewhere. And that's
Wakanda.
That's right. It was in Wakanda. And that's all I really remember.
Yeah, I actually, for a second, I had also forgotten that, like, Hawkeye and Ant-Man were in jail, and I realize that to some people who, like, really live and breathe these movies, that might sound like some kind of weird sacrilege, like, how could you forget? But, like, there's a lot of these movies, and, like, it's easy to just sort of let them congeal together if you're not constantly rewatching them.
Yeah,
like, getting the timeline a little off, it's not that weird.
To reiterate, I've watched these films once. I don't go back and revisit them to memorize details, and I know that's... my own fault.
Well,
because
it's not about memorizing details. People like them enough that they want to revisit.
It's to my detriment, though, because a lot of these details become very, very important as plot points later in the series. And these are not details that were important to me because I haven't watched the movie a lot.
Right.
I feel like this is a very... it feels really dated, this movie, because Black Widow is kind of a dated character.
Yeah, she's a product of the Cold War. Yeah.
A product of the Cold War. So it's about Russian spies, but it's not the Russian government. It's like this Russian super spy program, and she defects to not the American government, but this American superhero program. So it's like...
Which at the time was part of the government. The S.H.I.E.L.D. was part of the American government.
Okay.
So initially it was part of that, and then they became a separate thing. So it gets a little muddled. You see what I mean?
But this one starts with an introduction where we get to see Black Widow as a young girl and her younger sister being raised as the sort of like fake family in the 90s.
Yeah, it's kind of like that show The Americans. Their parents are played by David Harbour, who's great, and Rachel Weisz, who's also always great. They're a married couple, or so it seems, with two daughters. And then it turns out that they were in America to steal important intelligence secrets. And at the beginning of the film, what seems like an idyllic summer afternoon suddenly turns into, we have to flee the country immediately. Yeah. And they're burning their house down and destroying all their valuable heirlooms. And the younger sister has never known anything else, so she doesn't even know what's going on. There's a kind of cool bit where, like, they have to, like, run away in a plane, and, like, David Harbour all of a sudden, like, lifts up a giant industrial-strength crate. And you're like, oh, he's a superhero. I didn't know that. And then, like... You know, he has to, like, jump on the wing of the plane and shoot people. That's very James Bondy, with a little bit of superhero element. And honestly, I thought that was a pretty good opening for this. I actually liked the opening of this because it's not exactly where you expect it's going to open. Mm. It's a couple, and not like the giant twists, but, you know, they're taking it in a slightly different direction. And I like that we are establishing that this is a movie that is not about the Black Widow doing stuff, but this is about this character's past and relationships. And that's the sort of the core dynamic around which all of this other stuff, some of which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But because so much of the movie ends up being about her relationship with her sister, who isn't literally her sister, but they grew up kind of together, and her parents, who weren't really her parents, but were her only closest analog to parents. Yeah, because they had briefly had this kind of familial relationship, this is all they've got. They're actually very hollow, empty people, and they're kind of struggling to maintain these connections, tenuous though they are, toxic though they may be, because it's literally all they have in their past. And that was enough for me to kind of go along on some of the weirder parts of the journey.
Okay. Sure. There was that sort of idyllic opening that showed that they did have relationships, but I didn't sense any... because they revealed they're not a real family, I didn't sense that they ever had any kind of real connection. So they reunite.
They spent years pretending to be a real family.
We didn't see it or feel it, is
well,
my point.
Well, I get that, but you can't spend 3 years in the theater. You got to truncate it with editing.
Well, show more flashbacks. All show right. more at the beginning. Have a longer introduction. There are other
fair
ways
enough.
Around this.
All right, fair enough.
And a Black Widow, her name is Natasha, because people don't go by their superhero names in these.
Well, it's important to remember that also, like, and Natasha was very much like the Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yeah, and, like, and in fact, they...
stereotypical Russian name. The character was written like 50 years ago. So,
Though Scarlett Johansson has abandoned trying to do any kind of Russian accent.
Long since.
All the other characters are, and they all sound like Moose and Squirrel accents.
Yeah, they're not. They're pretty broad.
Because they have like the sort of Soviet era Moose and Squirrel, it's like, what year is this supposed to be? Can you not set this in, like, 1986?
Because it's weird, Black Widow as a character was created during the Cold War, back when this whole America-Russian thing was very open and at a peak, and it was just basically, there was a lot of caricature running around over, like, American heroes, or British heroes, or Russian anti-heroes, or villains, and Black Widow was very much a part of that.
Yeah.
And so trying to keep that alive today, you end up with this Mission Impossible situation where it's like, technically this would only make sense in the 1980s, but we have to pretend like people are still acting like the exact same way sometimes.
And the actual plot is straight out of like a G.I. Joe cartoon. Yeah. There's some evil bastard played by Ray Winstone, playing a Russian.
Not that his parentage factors into it.
Pardon?
Just because his parents weren't married doesn't mean anything.
It's
a term I'm trying to retire.
In the
Okay, I'm sorry. Weird thing to pick on. Yeah,
it's. I apologize. I was using a modern colloquialism.
Yeah.
he's the bad guy, and he has access to essentially mind control gas. He can shoot this red cloud of gas in your face and wipe out your mind. In his employ, he has a killer robot called the Taskmaster.
It's a cyborg.
It's like a skull face robot monster, and it chases after. And
it's his Winter Soldier, basically. And the whole thing with the Taskmaster is it's got what in the comics they called photographic reflexes, which is if you see someone do something like a cool acrobatic move or a martial arts style or something, it can do that.
Yeah, just show that thing Bruce Lee movies.
So I think they probably did, and that's why throughout the movie you'll see it doing like memorable fight stances and moves from like other Avengers movies, because it's been watching like footage of Captain America and Hawkeye doing stuff, which is admittedly pretty cool.
Okay. Again, a detail I wouldn't have picked
up.
No,
I appreciate that, but I noticed.
But yeah, through all of the machinations with the mind erase gas, Natasha has to reunite with her younger sister, who's now played by Florence Pugh, and her father and mother, who you said are played by David Harbour and Rachel Weisz. We learn that her faux father used to be essentially Captain Soviet.
Yeah, Red Guardian.
Red Guardian. Yeah. He was the Soviet only, Captain America.
The only Soviet attempt at a super soldier. Worked pretty well. I wonder why they stopped, but okay.
But when we catch up with him, and I don't think I explain why, but he's in a prison. He's like in a gulag somewhere.
He talked back to like people. I think they said like he wanted to be like more like old fashioned Cold War, Soviet heroism, and they just sort of shoveled him under a rug. Yeah. Basically, just got rid of him. Like pretend he doesn't exist anymore. And So what happens at the beginning of the movie is Florence Pugh, playing Natasha's younger sister, now all grown up, is one of the lead assassins in this all-female Soviet spy enclave, led by, or at least allegedly led by, because he apparently died in the past, Ray Winstone, the main bad guy. She's been brainwashed, and not in the usual way, but with that chemical you were talking about. And one of her brethren has managed to escape with a gas that can undo... Like that, it was a cure for the toxic gas. And just as she kills this person for like trying to stop their evil mission, she's hit with the gas, and all of a sudden she realizes what she did and has, a conscience again and feels terrible. And she goes on the lam. And Natasha ends up catching wind of this. They end up teaming up together. They have to reunite their family. They have to break their dad out of prison. It all ends up in a big, giant action sequence in the sky. The action's fine. Like, it's not, like, blow-your-mind action. I was engaged by it. It was just literally the only thing I really cared about was they got a good ensemble together. Mm-hmm. I like seeing Florence Pugh act. And if you got her to act opposite Scarlett Johansson, who at this point is very comfortable in this role, get her to act opposite David Harbour, who is always a good actor. Rachel Weisz is always a good actor.
David Harbour and Florence Pugh are just excellent.
Yeah.
And even though this is... to get into the criticism, I think kind of a nondescript movie. I feel like they're trying to bring a lot of personality.
And I think they succeed.
To their characters, perhaps, but the movie itself feels very gray. Not in terms of morals, just in terms of there's no color to it. There's not a lot of pizzazz. This feels like a really disposable spy flick that you like... caught on a whim in the 90s. It feels very dated in terms of not just its politics, but also its tone.
Yeah.
And this is another frustrating example of this series kind of being a little bit too beholden to the house style rather than letting the director take over. The director has previously made movies like Somersault and Laura, which are really highly, highly acclaimed by critics. And I haven't seen those movies, but I couldn't sense anything from like that has a voice or a point of view in this movie. It feels like another churny action machine, and that was a little disappointing.
The director's name is Kate Shortland.
Kate Shortland, an Australian director. And I was kind of hoping that maybe she could bring a little bit of pizzazz to this, something that has a little bit more excitement.
She did that movie Lore. I remember that movie.
Yeah, I said. And, okay,
sorry, it took me a second.
And yeah, so the action feels weirdly kind of flat. Not that it's big, it's just like shot in sort of a different sort of way that makes it feel like less engaging than usual. Maybe I'm spoiled by the Russos, who have like such a wonderful second unit team that the action is like really impressively choreographed.
It's always hard to say who's responsible for the action sequence, because second unit is so in charge of of just getting that done and letting the Marvel often seems to rely on their second unit team taking control of the action sequence so that the directors can focus on the narrative. I think the action's hit or miss here. I think it's all fine. Like, it's all perfectly good Bourne Identity action chases. I thought the prison break scene was well handled. I enjoyed the whole bit with the helicopter and David Harbour constantly having to, like, readjust where he's supposed to go in order to escape, and he's getting annoyed by it. All that shit's kind of fun. There's a car chase that pissed me off, because it's fine at first. It's just Florence Pugh and Scarlett Johansson trying to get away from the Taskmaster. And then the Taskmaster, like, shoots, like, an explosive arrow under their car or Jeep or whatever the hell they're driving. And it blows up, and they get, like, knocked down staircases into a subway, and then they just walk out of the car, and I'm like, could you at least stagger? Like, I mean, you were just spun around in a car, and that car was getting... This is not death-proofed, okay? You're not fine. I was in a fender bender once, and it fucked up my knee permanently. Can we at least... allow that getting into a massive car accident will make anyone get a little stumbly for a second as they get their equilibrium. I will settle for that. Just pretend that's a thing, please.
And I feel like this is a frustrating thing about these movies as well, is they've never really given us the actual rules of some of these heroes. Yeah. Like Thor, I don't know what the limits of Thor's power are.
Yeah.
I don't even know what his superpowers are exactly.
Strength, magic hammer, and lightning.
Yeah, that's kind of it.
Yeah, and he lives, like, a ridiculously long time.
And he's very long-lived.
Yeah, he's, like, 1,000 years old already.
So, yeah, like, a little bit more insight. Like, actual scenes of her training.
These are supposed to be people. These are not supposed to be super people.
These don't have superpowers, but,
so, like, when you treat them like super people, it's a little weird.
Yeah, what they're capable of living through would have been nice. Like, oh, I was trained to roll in this. Like, establish that. Show a whole sequence. There was a movie that came out a couple of years ago called Red Sparrow, which is kind of like the more adult version of this story.
It's also really shitty and misogynistic.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a bad movie.
It's about a misogynistic system.
But I think the movie doesn't do a very good job of not being misogynistic.
It's not expertly handled, but I think it at least covers a lot of what this is covering in a little bit more straightforward a fashion. Like, this is the kind of things that these young women are subjected to. Red Sparrow has a little bit too much of the, like, Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS vibe about it. It's like an exploitation movie.
Yes, they wanted to leer too much. It's really gross.
But at least we get sort of a good snapshot as to the suffering. Black Widow alluded to what she went through in Avengers Age of Ultron. She had this speech about her origin story.
Yeah, we saw a couple of flashbacks.
Which was, like, very, very brief.
Like, Julie Delpy was her trainer for a while. Yeah, which I always thought they were going to go back to that and make that important, because Julie Delpy's actually a good get. Like, I want to see more of Julie Delpy in anything, and no, we're not going to...
No, not going to do Julie Delpy.
Weird. Okay.
Couldn't get her back, I guess. And then they talk about it again in this movie, which is essentially reiterating what Scarlett Johansson said in the last Avengers movie. And I never got a sense of, like, what this experience was like for them. Was it something they were really excited about? Was it something that they resented?
No, they were not excited about it.
Was it something that they hated?
They talk about it. It was abuse. That's why they're trying to escape. That's the whole plot of the movie.
They're eventually trying to take it down.
It's not exciting. They hate this. They've had their lives taken away from them.
I'm hearing it, but I'm not feeling it.
I appreciate that you feel like the flip attitude and the sense of humor that permeates out the MCU undermines the level of tragedy and trauma that's supposed to be at the heart of this movie. I appreciate that, and that's fair. I think there are moments in this movie when that gets stripped away pretty well. There's a really great... The best scene in the movie is just when they're all, like, briefly, like, they're reunited and they start having dinner together, kind of. But it's really perverse and wrong, and, like, mom is ordering a pig to stop breathing, and it's really horrifying. She doesn't even acknowledge how horrible that is. And for a moment, they fall into their old patterns, and Natasha's just disgusted by it. And for a moment, it feels like we're actually, like, okay, we're actually, like, dealing with a lot of, like, the legacy of your relationships together. And whenever that part gets to play out, whether it's just Natasha and Yelena, Florence Pugh's character, or whether it's David Harbour and Rachel Weisz, you know, starting to rekindle old feelings. When all of that stuff's good. That's the best part of this movie. As I think the cast is really good. I think it would have been nice if they had even more, but, like, what they have, they work with really beautifully, and I think that that elevates what is otherwise, I'll grant you, like a 3-star spy movie. Mm. Like, it's as just a spy movie, it's okay. Like, the action's fine, the plot's pretty good. Ray Winstone really is a piece of shit, and I kind of appreciate just how evil he is, because sometimes
he's good at playing those types of roles.
Marvel sometimes likes to hedge their bets a bit on, like, how evil they'll let the characters really feel, and like, sometimes it's good.
They're actually kind of sympathetic. No, just have them be evil, they're supervillains.
Sometimes it's okay to just have evil, and here they're extraordinarily evil. Mm. Good. And sometimes people just deserve what's, you know, deserve to have a superhero after them, that kind of thing. So all of that stuff is fine. Yeah, this feels like just a good... this is just Marvel's answer to Bond. They tried to do some of their own stuff in it. The actual... many elements of the movie are a mixed bag, but at this point, I'm actually impressed, because I feel like... I agree with you to an extent that I feel like Natasha Romanoff had heretofore been somewhat underexplored in the MCU in general. Mm-hmm. And I think in the course of one movie, they managed to tell a story that is very much about her experience. Not just her doing stuff. Not her going after some magical space rock. But just dealing with her own past and people in it and introducing a big ensemble. Mm. And they all make the most of it. So ultimately, I really like this. It's not like superlatively amazing, but I think it's an action movie that is elevated by its cast.
Okay, I agree with you on some of the cast members. They did hire some very talented people. Mm-hmm. I just wish they'd given them more interesting things to do and interesting things to say. And to repeat, it's a kind of a bland flick. I don't hate it. I don't think it's doing anything necessarily wrong or offensive. But
it's not connecting with you.
Yeah, it just has no tone, no substance, nothing for me to sort of dig my fingernails into.
Yeah,
and. Given how entertaining some of these things have been, we know this series can be thoughtful.
Yeah, Black Panther was excellent.
Black Panther is excellent. I'm very fond of Iron Man 3 because that's sort of about actually like facing consequences
and growing
and doing and you know kind of moving on with your life and changing as a character. I feel like there's nothing that like that here. And in fact, the fact that the character would have to go on to do other things and then is already dead, kind of paints them into corner a lot.
I'm actually going to agree with you a little bit there, because I feel like, again, we know that this is a movie about a Black Widow who had been kind of like a bit of a loner and never really made like strong connections with other characters in the franchise, coming to terms with her own very troubled past and how her failure, not her fault, to develop meaningful connections over her life. And at the end of the movie, obviously she's alive because she dies later. But like at the end of the movie, she comes to terms with a lot of that. She comes to peace with a lot of that. And so the ending that we eventually see in Endgame, where it's her or Hawkeye, and it's like one of us has to sacrifice ourselves in order to get this magic stone. Her ultimate justification is like, you have people you care about that are waiting for you. And I'm like, I saw Black Widow. So do you, Natasha. Like, it's a little bit of a dick move. I appreciate that he's a father and that matters, the implication in that movie, and I'm sure they just hadn't really like fully thought this one out yet, is that she never had a meaningful connection. But by the end of this movie, it feels like she does.
Kind of gave her one. Yeah.
And so it kind of undercuts that a little bit and makes that a little less... I need to rewatch it. Maybe when I rewatch Endgame someday, maybe it'll work. But in my head, it makes that scene less strong.
She went to her grave previously without those meaningful connections. That was just a consequence of her being raised in the spy program.
And now we found out that she had them and she had earned them between movies.
We're going to do Black Widow 2. Okay. It's going to take place immediately after this one. Fine. And it's going to be about her losing those connections again.
I'm going to throw it out there. The Fast and the Furious movies, Fast and the Furious, like, 3 through, like, the first part of 7, all took place between other films.
That's true.
So fuck it.
So why not?
There's plenty of stuff you could do. I'd be fine with it. I wouldn't actually complain about that. I actually wouldn't. And also, clearly they're setting up Florence Pugh for more things, and honestly, Florence Pugh in all the things, please.
Florence Pugh is wonderful.
She's great. She really makes an impression here. As she has in every role she's ever done.
Although I do see this as yet another... sort of corporate move to recast all the original characters.
Yeah. They've introduced on a little bit.
They've introduced the multiverse, which means they can just keep recasting these characters ad infinitum, which makes me want to care about them a little less.
We'll see how they handle it, because like Loki's in the middle of making that whole thing.
Yeah, it's like the conversation we had about when they make a new sequel that asks you to ignore other chapters that you had previously been involved in.
Yeah,
it's like you're toying with our emotions. Like, yeah, you feel like you've been cheated a little bit.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It's like, I was connected to those others. I'm not supposed to be anymore.
And this one, I don't feel like it's cheating because it's basically just, hey, it's because that's the thing. Like DC Comics is always better about this than Marvel. Mm-hmm. The idea of legacy characters, where it's like this name has been passed down from generation to generation.
Yeah. In fact, like Robin has been like there's been like 8 Robins or something.
I don't know what the national number, but there's been several Robins. Mm-hmm. There's been several the Flashes. There's been several. Like Batman, Wonder Woman, and Superman, not so many of those, but a lot of the other superheroes have had other versions of themselves, and they've just passed the torch.
Yeah.
And it's considered fine, you know? And it's sort of like, it's a legacy that matters. It's like, why, just because we have all new members on our football team, we're still the Giants or whatever, I don't know. Like, it's, the name matters, and like the legacy of that name matters. Yeah. And so I don't mind if after this, Florence Pugh is the new Black Widow. A, because Florence Pugh is awesome. Yeah. And B, it makes sense for a character. I buy it. Like, fuck it. It works here. I'm excited for that. And it could work for other heroes, too. Like, there could be another Iron Person out there. There have been in the comics, actually.
Yeah. In fact, there's a movie coming up. I don't even know what it is. Huh. Isn't there one called Ironheart, or is that a TV show?
I don't know if that's going to be a TV show or a movie, or if that's even official yet. But yeah, someone else was in the Iron Man suit, exactly.
That's an Iron Man thing?
Iron Man. Yeah. It's it's from the comics after I stopped reading it regularly, but there's a woman who's
Is it Gwyneth Paltrow?
No.
Do we get? Oh,
I mean, she might be in it, but I don't know. But it's not her. At least that's not the character. I really like that scene in
Iron Man 3 where she puts on like just a single arm of like the Iron Man blaster, and she like murders the bad guy and just turns around and says, "That was really violent." She's really shaken by that.
All right, we need to move on. Yeah. Speaking of movies, the people are in. Mm-hmm. Segway.
What?
Let's talk about speaking of sequels. How's that? Movies that are part of a franchise. Let's talk about Fear Street 1978. Last week we talked about Fear Street 1994. This is a trilogy of horror movies. And they're being released one a week, so next week we'll have the final installment. They're all directed by Lee Janiak, who had previously directed the really excellent and somewhat underseen horror movie Honeymoon. And they're based off of the works of R.L. Stine, and what we are seeing is the history of a cursed town. A witch was killed in 1666. She cursed the town, and then throughout history, every 10 years or so, at least once a generation, someone just becomes possessed by the witch and turns into a homicidal maniac. And a slasher villain, basically. In 1994... we were introduced to various characters who, through a series of machinations, wound up being stalked by slashers from multiple generations of this curse.
Like, they manifested, like, from throughout history, and they were all stalking the main characters at the
same time. Very, very fun. Very, very fun. And at the end of it, one of them is still cursed by the witch, and they have to figure out how they're going to stop it. And the premise of Fear Street 1978 is that they find a survivor from a previous slashing at a summer camp, Camp Nightwing, in 1978, and she tells them what she went through in the hopes that maybe they'll figure out some sort of clue that will help them solve the problem once and for all.
1994 was a riff on... it wasn't a riff on 90s slashers, because that's kind of when the genre was considered kind of dead.
Mm-hmm. Until Scream came along.
Yeah, until Scream. But yeah, you had like Halloween 6 and Hellraiser 4, and things were just sort of petering out at that point in terms of the genre.
But there was a bit of self-reflexivity, you know, sort of a meta-narrative. We're playing with the genre. It's a bit of a riff on Scream.
But 94 was also the year of Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which was also a meta-narrative on the slasher genre that Freddy Krueger was a part of. Kind of, arguably. Anyway.
Yeah.
So that one was a little bit of like a a little bit of a meta riff, I suppose. Mm.
But it was loose and was able to be its own thing.
It was loose and it had a clever idea, and that's we're going to have a bunch of slashers from throughout history stalking our main characters. And that film was actually incredibly good about, I think, really establishing those characters. I loved those characters.
Yeah.
And there's some really wonderful bits of dialogue. I didn't say it last week, but there's a bit near the end where the main character is saying to her girlfriend, like, when we're done with all of this, I'm going to take you on a date, we're going to get a burger, listen to the Pixies, make out, and have the best night of our lives. And it's like, that line nearly made me cry. It's like, that's like the sweetest thing. And 1978 is a lot more of a riff on slashers of the past. That is, specifically Sleepaway Camp and Friday the 13th.
And The Burning.
And The Burning.
But all of which were set at various summer camps. Yeah. They're basically campfire stories brought to life in which a bunch of kids and counselors at various summer camps are stalked by some maniac in the woods.
Yeah. The last one, the characters were actually like intelligent and actually kind of affable. They were really upbeat a lot of the time. They had a good sense of humor. In 1978, the characters are all horrible.
Mostly assholes.
They're all assholes. Even the main characters at the start of the film are like just horrible to each other. The main characters are a pair of sisters, one of whom is a camp counselor, and she's really hoping to essentially beef up her resume so she can get out of town and go out of state to college.
Yeah, she's trying to get out of, because as we've established this town again, it's cursed, it's terrible, people don't leave very often, and she's doing everything she can to just play her cards right, get good grades, get all the extracurriculars, get letters of recommendation, and get the fuck out. And her sister, who is a little younger, the elder sister's name is Cindy, the younger sister's name is Ziggy. Her sister is a little younger, and she's mad that her sister has started to pull away from her and started, like, sort of eschewing their life together in order to move on with the next phase, because she's alone and picked on, and it sucks.
And she has resigned herself to a life of misery. She says, we never move out. There's no point in doing anything. She's become very nihilistic. And evidently, they also used to be incredibly naughty together. They talk about, like, all of the pranks they used to pull and damage they used to do.
Yeah.
And she kind of resents that. And in fact, she has other friends throughout the movie who kind of resent that she's pretending to be kind of a goody-goody. You complained last week that 1994 takes a while to get going. This one takes a long time to get going, because they have to show the flashback in 94 to establish all of this. Mm-hmm.
Which I think they do pretty efficiently.
Pretty efficiently, but then we get to the camp and they spend a long time setting up a new whole cast of characters. So when the actual premise of, like, the slasher comes along, that is, one of the camp members becomes possessed and he takes up an axe and starts murdering people. And, what's going on and how they can actually figure out what the curse is has to do with, you know, they figured out that it has to do with Sarah Fear, that's the name of the witch, where she might be buried. She might be buried at the camp, and how to break the curse and stop all of the killing.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the killings just continue.
And this is, I will say this, the body count of this movie is huge.
Oh, it's gigantic.
And it's sometimes you'll watch some of those summer camp movies and they're being very, very careful. Like, listen, we're only going to kill the asshole counselors. We're not going to kill any nice people. We're not going to kill, like, the kids at the camp. This is not one of those. Everyone is on the chopping block. It's pretty brutal. And that's why, even though I think my issue with 1994 wasn't that it took a while to get going. Mm-hmm. My issue was that the pacing just felt kind of choppy beforehand.
Okay.
And it didn't really feel like I'm being guided along in the story. It feels like we actually almost have too much story. And it honestly probably would have been better if it was longer than if it was shorter, because it just felt like we were racing from thing to thing and I couldn't get my bearings, and it wasn't until the action finally kicked in that I could and things settled down and it was clear who the protagonists are, because it actually even wasn't for a while, and then by that point I fell in love with it. Here, I don't mind so much because I think this film actually very tidily sets up all of the characters of the summer camp, all of the goings-on, all of the parallel narratives, who's mad at who, who's picking on who, what's going on with this big camp, like, competition happening at night, which is basically a capture the flag thing. It's establishing the relationships much more cleanly, and as a result, I wasn't bored by it. I actually didn't feel like it was, and especially helped that once the horror really kicks in and the person actually does get officially possessed and start killing people, it it goes from 0 to 60 like in like 5 seconds.
That's
it,
for sure.
The second half is brutality.
It's just a bloodbath. People are crawling through catacombs.
So I feel like the wait was worth it. And I feel like a lot of the old slasher movies that this is based on, films like The Burning or even Sleepaway Camp, they're slow to get started too. There's like a couple of murders at the beginning, but it does feel like we're kind of waiting for that one spree killing that's going to take up the last act. And here the last act is the second half of the film. So it kind of works.
I feel like a film like Sleepaway Camp was a lot better about sort of establishing the place and the characters during that time.
Yeah, well, that one has a very specific tone and point.
Whereas I think this one has such a large ensemble of characters and so much to talk about in the past that during these slower moments where we should have been establishing character, we're expositing a little too much. Just a little bit of a taste.
It didn't bug me, but
I do really like this movie because it does what 1994 did, and that is establish a lot of really good characters and relationships.
Yeah.
And by the end, when the two sisters and a mutual friend of theirs are kind of...
Alice, played by Ryan Simpkins, and they are great. That's a breakout role for Ryan Simpkins.
Yeah. Ryan Simpkins is really, really wonderful, and the two leads are very, very wonderful, and all three of them together... when they finally do have scenes together, you get that wonderful sense that they actually had a relationship before.
Yeah, their actual connections
So once we get to those scenes near the end where the characters are actually connecting and relating, it becomes really, really good.
Yeah, I really care.
And there's
a lot.
Actually stuff at stake at that point when you care about the characters.
And I think that's the trick for what makes there's a lot of very watchable slasher movies in which it's the characters are broadly drawn and it's mostly about a kill count and clever deaths, and those can be very entertaining in their own right. But for me, what makes a great slasher is when a character dies and you're going, no,
I
liked them. And there's actually not all that many slashers that I feel I can say that about. It's one of the reasons why I think Friday the 13th Part 2 is arguably the best in that franchise.
Oh,
because
definitely.
There's a couple people who die in that movie. I'm like, no, I really like them. Harper's Island, that great slasher series we watched. There's a couple of deaths towards the end where it's on a bridge where I'm like, every time I watch it, those are the best characters. Why are you doing this to me, Harper's Island?
The deaths on the bridge, yeah.
Oh my God.
I understand they try to kill people off in great numbers to show raising stakes, but... It's really rare, especially in a slasher, to care about the victims. In fact, one of the I think one of the big appeal of the slasher genre in general is its abiding nihilism.
Yeah,
where you're going in there because you don't care about humanity.
There's
you
a
just
lot of efficiency.
See, people are reduced to meat. It's like watching people getting killed is a party now. And I think 1978 is a little bit more sensitive about that. It's trying to establish these actual characters and set up stakes so the deaths actually mean something.
Yeah.
And there's something actually at stake in all of this that is A, breaking the curse, and B, mending a teenage lesbian relationship in the 90s.
Yeah, all of this, we're watching this entire horrible summer camp slaying in 1978, and the reason why is so that two girls can get back together in the 90s, and I love that that's what's really
at stake here.
Because this has all happened in the past, so this is all done, and although the tease for the next film, Fear Street 1666, it feels like all bets are off on that one. I don't know what the hell that movie's going to be at all.
There's going to be psychic projecting into the past.
Yeah, is it going to be The Crucible or The Witch or some other fucking thing? I have no idea. And honestly, after these two movies, do what thou wilt. I love these two. I really do. If they stick the landing here, we're looking at a horror classic, I think.
If they don't do anything to betray this, but these first two have been really quite good. This is just an exciting slumber party movie for teenagers.
Yeah.
They're really good, just hard. I want to say they're kind of light horror movies. They're not.
No, they're R-rated, but they're not gonna break your brain or make you question if there's any good left in the universe.
Yes,
they're violent. There's some sex in them, but
it's not
mostly
one of my favorites. Like somebody getting coated with mud and going mad in the woods. It's the story and characters
and.
And as that, they're just really good horror entertainments. And I'm really looking forward to 1666. And I really hope they don't whiff it. Because there's ways to blow this.
There's
that
totally
I'm
ways
all,
to blow this.
Already picturing.
And based on the whole, next time on Fear Street, because they ended on a little trailer.
At the end,
And seriously, I'm looking at this and I'm like, I don't know what movie you're making right now. Like, I really don't. This could be, this amazing, clever, rule-breaking finale, or you could be totally whiffing this, and I don't know yet. Yeah. However, I will say this. After two great Fear Street movies, and again, I think Honeymoon is great, Legionnaires bought, like, a lot of goodwill from me.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm willing, obviously I'm on board, I'm excited, and I'll judge it based on whatever it is, but it could do it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what if they do it?
What if they do it?
What if they actually...
What if
Rocky goes the distance? Like, what if he really does?
It's the teen slasher version of Small Axe.
Yeah, a little bit.
I felt that way with, like, Small Axe. Yeah. Like, this is a really exhilarating project. I hope there's not, like, a bad one.
Small Axe is more ambitious in a lot of ways. Right. I'm sure more meaningful in a lot of ways. But again, it's just sort of like, how are they keeping up this level of quality this long? Yeah, it is like that. Oh, so, anyway, please don't miss the Fear Street movies if you haven't seen them yet. They're really excellent, and there's another one coming this week.
Big, obvious soundtracks.
This one's a little less in your face and obvious. Like, it's not like a new track every 5 seconds this time.
That's true.
And I'm actually curious, were any of them anachronistic? I didn't notice.
A couple, but I'm not gonna. I'm gonna stop nitpicking now.
If that's the problem, that's not a problem. Yeah. All right, let's move on. There's a horror movie I saw and you didn't, and I want to talk about it because I'm actually very impressed by it. Because it came and went. I think it had a very, very small theatrical release earlier this year, but now it's a Shudder exclusive, so a lot more eyes are going to see it. It's a film called Son, S-O-N. It stars Andy Matichak, who played Jamie Lee Curtis's granddaughter in Halloween, the new one.
Okay.
And Emile Hirsch is in it as well. At the beginning of the movie, Andy Matichak is pregnant and on the run in the middle of the night, and we don't know from whom. The implication is that she was kidnapped, and specifically, as we eventually learn, she was on the run from possibly a cult. Hmm. We cut to a couple of years later. She is a single mother. She's a teacher, and her son, played by Luke David Blum, no relation to David, no relation to the Blumhouse guy. Spelled differently.
Jason Blum. Yeah.
She's a single mom. She's got a son. They have a good relationship. Things are going well. And then one day, and this shot scared the shit out of me. Like, and I'm not an easy scare, like just like a jump scare. Like, I was totally just lulled into their day-to-day routine. Just one day, she like walks into his room and there's a whole bunch of people there. And it's just like,
that's not disturbing at all.
And it's not like, you know, all of a sudden there's a monster. It's just like, they shouldn't be there. What the fuck is going on?
It's like
And then the door slams and she can't get back in and she has to run across the street and ask for help. And by the time she gets back, they're gone. But now, like, her son is like, he's clearly something's happened and he's really, really weird. And she calls the cops and she tries to explain and they believe her to an extent, but there's no evidence. So it's not like they're saying you're just, you all made it up, but they're saying it's like, we will look into it, but we found no evidence. Emile Hirsch plays the cop who wants to believe her. And then her son starts having weird medical issues that they can't explain. He starts having seizures, he won't eat, he's covered in blood, and no one can explain it. Eventually, she tells Emile Hirsch that she was indoctrinated into a cult. Or she was, when she was a little girl, she had no control over it. And she was horrifically mistreated. And she believes that the cult is back to claim the child. And the doctors don't believe her. And I don't want to ruin where it goes from here. It's frustrating because I feel like if I told you a little bit more, people might be more excited to see it. But just seeing the way it unfolded and how naturally it unfolded and how it became kind of different movies a couple of times. Not in this wild, fun, wacky, The Guest kind of way. Just in terms of like the way the horror evolves from something very grounded, very Sundance, you know, Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, to something with more frightening,
like horror potential.
More horror overtones. But even that might be completely subjective. It's all granted by Andy Matichak, who is a young actor. I'm not super familiar with her outside of Halloween. I really liked her in Halloween. And here, she carries this whole movie really beautifully. I buy every single moment with her. You know, she's a young actor, but you really buy that she has this maternal bond. And she really does read as though she's been raising this kid. for like 10 years. And she's just nails every single part of this absolutely traumatic experience. And what she will do to protect her son is increasingly horrifying. The situations that she's put in and the way she has to navigate out of them. The kid is simultaneously a victim and a nightmare. The story is simple yet elegant, I think, in its execution. I really, 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 really recommend this one.
Okay.
Like, it's not instant classic material, but it got under my skin in a way that not a lot of horror movies have lately, just in terms of, like, and I love, you know me, I love horror, but, like, just in terms of, like, oh, God, what's going to happen next? Like, that's not easy to do as efficiently as this movie does. Mm. And yeah, I really do think this one got a little underserved. I think people didn't really give it enough of an eye, and I hope people do, because it's really good.
I've been really impressed. I didn't see this one, but yeah. I've been really impressed with a lot of the films that Shudder has distributed.
Yeah, they've got good taste for the most part.
Yeah, they're not just sort of like scooping up whatever horror they can. They're actually really carefully curating their channel. And as such, when you see an original on Shudder, you're probably going to be in for something kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of really good original horror films through Shudder
year. And even the ones I don't like, they've got ambition or they're like trying something interesting.
I know you weren't a big fan of Caveat, but I liked Caveat a lot. There's The Queen of Black Magic earlier this year. There's, of course, with Psycho Gorman, which is a wonderful film.
I liked Skull the Mask, which was a little sort of unambitious. Actually, that's not true. It's sort of, it's just kind of sloppy, but it was so gory and weird. You just had to love it.
I got to see, speaking of sloppy and gory, I got to see Fried Berry this year.
Was that movie Porno that they did? Or did they release?
Porno is, it's
that's one that I didn't care for, but really, I appreciate the appeal.
It's sleazy. It was set in a movie theater, and I worked my whole life in movie theaters, so it got a lot of those like little details. So I like those parts of it.
Yeah.
And of course, they did Lucky, which is one of my favorite films of this year,
okay.
Which is about a woman who's stalked by a slasher who vanishes when he dies in her house, and then just comes back the next day, and nobody believes her.
Okay.
And that's a really, really good movie. I'm going to try to check out Sun if I ever get a few free moments.
I do recommend it. It's a lean, it's like a 90-minute movie, very efficient, and just very well told, and it scared me.
Okay.
And that's something I think any horror movie can say that.
Yeah.
That's a definite recommendation. Now, let's move on to a very different film. A film both you and I saw. And if you'll recall, a couple of weeks ago, I told a little anecdote where, you know, because every week we try to scramble and watch as many movies as we can, and we don't always get a chance to watch the same movies, and sometimes we just miss something.
Mm.
But every once in a while, one of us will see a movie, and we'll text the other one and say, don't miss this. And a couple of weeks ago, Whitney sent me a text in the middle of the week, do not miss Werewolves Within, you will love it.
You'll love Werewolves Within.
And I feel like I owed him a solid, so earlier this week I told him, whatever you do, do not miss a chance to see the movie Summertime. And yeah, it worked out well. Summertime is amazing.
Summertime is one of those films that like Richard Linklater's Slacker, which you compared it to.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot more like Waking Life in a lot of ways because it has this unreality feeling to it.
There's a similar vibe though. It's a sort of sprawling narrative.
In that it is going so far as to try to put the button on a whole generation. And this is, you know, whereas Slacker and Waking Life were very much Slacker came out in 1990, Waking Life came out in 99. These are kind of like Richard Linklater's generation. He's Generation X. This is the millennial movie.
Yeah.
And it takes place in, with excruciating detail, in neighborhoods around Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's set in 2019. It's clearly shot around that same time. Mm. Very much pre-pandemic. It starts off in like Santa Monica and it ends around downtown.
It starts on Venice Pier.
Oh, was it Venice Pier? Okay.
Yeah. It starts on Venice Pier.
At the beach and it moves inward. And it moves inland throughout the film.
There's a young woman singing a song. She's playing a guitar. She kind of roller skates down the streets like, yes, and I'm in Venice. And then she runs into somebody just like you do in Venice.
Uh-huh.
Like actually crashes into somebody.
Yeah. And then the story follows that person.
They have a conversation. They go into a restaurant. We follow some other people. And every time we stop and talk with a new group of people.
A new narrator, a new protagonist.
And there's a new protagonist. And we stop eventually. We start revisiting characters after a little while. But they don't just have a conversation. They recite a poem.
Yeah.
That, as it turns out, the actors have composed themselves.
Yeah.
They're all poets, local poets who live in Los Angeles, and they've written a lot of poems about living in Los Angeles.
This movie has about as many writing credits as the Flintstones.
But in a good way.
But in a good way. If you recall, the John Goodman movie, the Flintstones, a live action one from the 90s, has a comically large number of writers credited on IMDb. It's like completely absurd. But here it's intentional and it works.
I don't remember how many of those writers were credited like on screen in the movie.
Not as many as were actually like on that. But it's a well known.
But those big commercial, yeah. Like Black Widow has like one or two credited screenwriters.
Probably at least half a dozen. Yeah, yeah.
At least 12. Yeah, this one, each of the actors gets to sort of play a character that they've written a poem in the voice of.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are actually incredibly liberating. There's a really wonderful bit, and this was the moment where I fell in love with the movie, where there's a teenage girl having lunch outdoors with her mom
at a
restaurant, and they're just across the street from John's grocery store. And her mom has been giving her a lot of grief about the way she dresses, and she wears too much makeup, and you need to stop doing that.
Stop wearing red.
Yeah,
you
don't
know,
wear it's red. And so she gives a poem about how she wants to wear red and what that means to her and how that, you know, displays like who she is as a person, who she is as a woman.
How it
and,
has power.
Yeah. Yeah. And during this, the waitress from the restaurant comes out and she's wearing a red dress.
Mm.
And she sort of takes a step out of reality and manifests a couple dozen other waitresses in identical red dresses. And they do a dance number around a car in the middle of the street that they're really pissed at. And they end up pushing it off camera.
It's a great bit.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
But in addition to some a lot more meaningful things, there's also some a lot more modern, like somebody gives a poem about how she wishes she were more successful. She wishes she had more money. She wishes she was prettier, had a better boyfriend, like all these kind of petty concerns about how important they are to her.
Yeah.
And then there's another poem, and this was the one that kind of kicked off the movie. It was a poem about leaving Yelp reviews and how kind of an important experience that is. So these are all very specific to this generation and, you know, what it means to live on Yelp and what it means. And what this movie is doing is turning things that have been lambasted by certain article writers out there. Millennials are killing the blank industry. Did you know? Hey, millennials, did you know that you were that powerful?
Well, technically, every generation is that powerful. Yeah, if they all act in unison, anything can happen.
Just don't play golf; you kill the golf industry.
Oh no!
What a tragedy! this movie is turning all that inside out and turning it into essentially this artistic manifesto that all of these things that have been kind of lambasted and cast aside as frivolous things of the younger generation. We're no longer the youngest generation anymore, so maybe there's a little bit like bit of wistfulness coming along with it. All of this has been part of a grand artistic scheme to define ourselves.
Yeah, and I think this is a movie that I hope people embrace this because this feels like a movie that we can look back and it's a very mannered film because again they're speaking in spoken word poetry and it's you know there's an artificiality to that because it's not the way people generally speak. But the way they are expressing themselves is so direct and so clever and so thoughtful and so emotional. And I'm not ashamed to admit I cried. Why would I be ashamed to admit I cried? A good movie will make you do that. But like, I will admit, I cried multiple times, a couple of times in this movie where just people were, there's this wonderful bit where we see a woman and she's in therapy and she's trying to figure out her life. And then at the end of the movie, she finally gets to have some catharsis with the person who it turns out their rejection of her spurred a huge downward slide in her mental health.
Yeah.
And that whole bit is just bravo fucking well. What a great, for your consideration, like an amazing sequence.
Well, and it's incredibly honest. She wrote that poem. It's about a real person. That's about her real mental health.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a confessional quality to a lot of this movie as well.
I think my favorite scene is there's this incredible bit, and if you've ever worked retail,
this was my favorite bit too.
The scene at the burger joint. Retail. There's a burger joint called Smiley's, and it's about it's basically a huge rush and everyone is just ordering a million things and like taking up the line and slowing everything down and everyone behind the counter is miserable and someone orders like 60 burgers and then disappears.
Orders them and then leaves.
So like in the middle of rush hour we started making 60 burgers and so we couldn't help everyone else and then they dashed. They didn't even pay for it. And this one guy keeps getting promoted.
Yeah, the manager says, hey, you who's taking out the trash, work the register, and as soon as he takes the register, all of these minor disasters, yeah, but all at once begin like throwing, yeah, his way. He doesn't know how to handle these
and
things.
And then the manager freaks out more and more, and he gets promoted again, and he can't handle it. It's fucking miserable.
So he ends up getting up on the counter and delivering his poem.
It's
about
so
how
fucking
horrible
good
it is to work retail.
I also really liked, and at first I was a little concerned about this because I thought it was a little broader than the rest of it, but I think it gave it a nice little fantastical quotient. There's a couple of rappers who are performing on the street. They're trying to sell their album, and at the beginning of the movie they're talking about how, man, I don't know if we're ever gonna make it and everything's awful. And then over the course of this one day, whole movie takes place over one day, they are discovered.
Achieve fame.
They're discovered, they cut an album, and they get famous, and then they get like annoyingly famous.
Yeah, yeah.
And they start having regrets about how famous they've become over one day, which is very much how it feels sometimes in this city where everything moves so fucking fast. This movie made me so nostalgic for pre-pandemic Los Angeles.
Aww.
Where you could just walk around Venice Beach and there was this giant hive of creativity and weirdness, people of all different like walks of life just sharing the space, and you know that every single person you look at has a story. Like, LA doesn't always get like the best, I think, appreciation in cinema, because LA is a weird city. It's very spread out. It's not like this tight knit like New York City, everything built on top of each other.
There's no like singular vital center to
the city. There's no nightlife in this city. The city closes down around 10 or 11, except for a couple of clubs and like a Denny's. Like, that's it. Like, it's weird. And I think some people who aren't from here don't necessarily know the best way to capture it. And I think Summertime is one of the best LA movies I've ever seen. I think this movie gets it. I really do. And I think if you've never been to LA and you want to see a movie that maybe shows a side of it that doesn't get appreciated enough, this is a great movie for it. This is a great, just breath of fucking fresh air. And kudos to every single poet who was involved in this. Kudos to Carlos Lopez Estrada, the director of Blindspotting, who directed this. And boy, is that person. I didn't see Ryan the Last Dragon, which they also did. But just these two movies alone, what a voice that I want to follow.
Yeah, Blindspotting and now Summertime. Yeah, I'm going to keep on following Estrada's career.
Yeah.
And Ryan the Last Dragon, it's a Disney animated film, it feels like. Again, there's not much of an authorial stamp to films of a certain size.
But it sounds like it helped, like, you know, it sounds like it helped in a weird way, this movie. I mean, Kelly Marie Tran co-produced this, you know, so I guess he's spreading his influence out, connecting with more people on
Ryan the Last Dragon.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Good for Kelly Marie Tran.
Good for everybody involved here. Just, I love this movie
this is,
so much.
It's so, so good. It really is one of my favorites of the year.
Yeah, I will be very surprised. This is not on my list of the best films of the year. Mm. I'll be very, very surprised. I love it. And then lastly, we got one more movie to review, and it is called Genus, Pan.
Genus Pan. Genus Pan, as I mentioned earlier, is the latest film from Lav Diaz.
And you're going to need to tell some people who that is.
Lav Diaz is a Filipino filmmaker who is maybe best known for the lengths of his movies.
Which is a weird thing to be known for.
Well, because his movies tend to be incredibly long. Earlier this year, I saw my first Lav Diaz film. It was called From What Is Before. It was 5 hours and almost 45 minutes. It's a pretty long one.
Okay.
And he shoots his films himself. He shoots in a very crisp, clean black and white with a lot of deep focus. So there's a lot of static shots that kind of reach way back into the natural world. And in a lot of Lav Diaz films, people kind of live within that landscape, especially in From What Is Before. There's like going to be a long, wide open shot of a hill. And for a long time, you're not really sure what you're supposed to be looking at, but the camera will stay there. And eventually you'll make out somebody in the distance kind of walking very slowly toward the camera. People kind of merge in and out of the landscape. They're part of this place. Genus Pan is the opposite of that. Genus Pan is full-on Herzogian, the natural world is a hostile, horrible place kind of territory.
Jesus.
Lav Diaz has been... he was raised during the Ferdinando Marcos administration, dictatorship.
Yeah.
And has a lot of his films, from what I understand, tend to be about fascism and the rise of fascism and the ripple effects of dictatorship on not just the country, but on the souls of the people who live under it. And as such, it is about a certain kind of, from what is before, is a lamentation. But there is this sort of study of that degradation of the soul. Genus Pan is one of the most pessimistic films I've seen.
Okay, and hold on. Yeah, that's coming from Whitney, and he seeks this shit out.
It's not quite as bad as something like The Painted Bird, which was a film I reviewed last year. Which
your description of The Painted Bird guaranteed I will never see that film. I will never see that film if it's anything even remotely like you described, because I don't know if I could handle it.
I really like The Painted Bird, but yeah, that is just nothing but pain and anguish for like 3 hours.
Yeah, see, some people would call that hell. Literally hell. The thing that you don't want to experience so badly, you're supposed to change your entire life to make sure that you don't end up there. Whitney just seeks that out.
That's my jam. What can I say?
I'm not complaining. I just want to make sure everyone understands the context of the statement.
I admire when a filmmaker can understand and appreciate the aesthetics of misery. But Genus Pan is about, it takes place on this remote island where three workers, they're the main characters, have been essentially exploited. Like their bosses they're hired illegally. Their bosses are skimming all these like unseen fees off of their pay. They don't have a lot of money left. And if they want to avoid having to pay another fee going back to their home island, they have concocted a scheme to sail around to the opposite side, land on the opposite side, and then walk through the jungle back to their hometown.
Okay.
And this movie is about that journey of these three guys through the jungle back to their hometown.
Okay.
And how throughout this journey, they begin to reveal things about themselves, about their pasts, and all of the horrible things they've done in their pasts.
Mm.
Emblematic of this, there's a scene where two of the characters, their names are Paolo and Baldo. They're played by Bart Guingona and Namding Yosef. They reveal that they were previously circus performers, and they performed with this guy named Clown. And one scene, they're sort of wandering through this like thicket, and they hear this loud noise of an animal nearby. And I'm not really sure what kind of animal it is. It sounds like a bird. And one of them looks up and says, "Oh, look, Clown has come to visit us. Hello, Clown." And he starts making these noises and just trying to get the other guys in on this kind of fun game he's going to play. We're going to talk to the bird. And they kind of back off. They say, "Don't do that. No, don't talk to that bird as if it's a clown. And come on, let's play along. Let's do something. And quit making noise, bird." And like very quickly, it turns into this horrible scene of total torment and annoyance and pain until the point where they're just sort of screaming and they leave the screen saying, "Fuck you, clown." And that's kind of the journey of this movie. They try to play.
Oh my God.
They try to converse and they realize just sort of how much agony they've been in this whole time. The third of them is this younger guy named Andres, who is trying to sort of suss out what these guys are really about. Of the other two guys, one of them is devoutly Christian. The other one is incredibly nihilistic about the world. And early on in the film, he turned on the radio and we heard this audio broadcast. It was from Christian radio about how human beings have essentially not evolved past Genus Pan. The title of the movie, and that is...
Which is forest sprites with, glove and hooves.
No, Genus Pan is the genus of chimpanzees.
Ah.
And so we're essentially just as savage as we were when we were chimpanzees, and only, like, this was Christian radio, so they said only, like, the highest of minds, like Buddha, Christ, Mother Teresa, only certain people have been able to transcend this. Everybody else, you're fucked. And this is Lav Diaz spending 2 hours and 37 minutes telling us how fucked we are.
Cool.
And there's a really shocking moment of violence partway through that near the end gets rewritten. So we get to see two different versions of the same scene.
Okay.
And I think depending on your point of view, you get to choose which one is the real version.
Is it like along moral lines or like thematic is it one hopeful and one despondent? What are we?
Well, they're both despondent.
Great.
But
cool.
But one has a one recasts like sort of the character of one of the characters, like the actual integrity of one of the characters.
Okay.
And, but what Olav Diaz is saying here is that no matter which one is true, the dictatorship is going to kind of come after you anyway. Mm. And as such, there's no such thing as justice in this world. There's no such thing as coming out on top. You can't come to a change and expect things to change because we're in the shit.
Yeah.
And he leaves us on that note. Mm. Lav Diaz is really rubbing our noses in misery with this one.
So you love it?
Well, I don't love it as much as I love something like From What Is Before, which I think is a much more thoughtful film and is a much more ambivalent. It actually examines human nature in from a much more humane eye. This is, it's not cruelty, but it is nihilistic. And, so even though, Lav Diaz is dealing on a much smaller canvas than he ordinarily does, a mere 2 hours and 37 minutes, he is trying to paint a much broader picture of human nature. And his conclusions are not rosy. Mm. And there's a point to that. There, you know, a point that, you know, if you're raised in a dictatorship, and especially the rise of authoritarian governments all over the world, has sort of given a lot of reason to not hope. Lav Diaz is tapping into that. He is trying to say, maybe there really isn't here, okay? There's nothing to look forward to. And it's all because we're just a horrible species. Is that uplifting? No, it's not meant to be.
That's at it.
Is it meant to poke at a truth that we sometimes are tempted to feel? Definitely. And I think that there's a great deal of release and catharsis that can be found in that kind of darkness.
Fair enough. All right, well, on that note, let's review some movies.
Okay.
Okay, so we do our, at the end of every episode, we review movies on a scale of C- to C+. The highest a movie can get is a C+. It's above average. We recommend those movies. Mm-hmm. Could be the best movie ever made. Could just be rather good. Bada bing. C+. Most movies are a C. C is average. A little bit of good. A little bit of bad. C. You've been to school. And then C- is below average. Mm. We don't recommend those movies. Doesn't mean that they're necessarily a complete wash. But generally speaking, we did not care for them. It could be the worst movie ever made. Could just be a movie that misses its goals. On that scale, where does Genus Pan land?
It's a high C.
Okay.
I feel like it's a little too bloody-minded in its nihilism. Yeah. And while I do like Lav Diaz's aesthetic and his style, I feel like, given what I've seen from him before, he could have taken a little bit more time.
Yeah.
Could have taken another 2.5 hours if he wanted to. I think his longest film is close to 11 hours in length. One of them is nine. One of them is nine. One of them is eight. They tend to be around five. Mm-hmm. He could have taken a little bit more time and maybe given a little bit more whole a picture as to what was going on. But yeah, the way it stands, it's actually very effective nightmare of a movie.
Okay. On the opposite side of things, Summertime is an absolute, and I say this, and I mean it when I say this. This is a phrase that gets used a lot, but I mean, like, imagine you're stuck in your apartment for like a year and a half, and then you step outside and get a breath of fresh air. That's Summertime.
Yeah,
it is an absolute relief of a movie. It felt like going outside again, and then not in a way that I think is just specifically key to the moment, although that matters, but in a way that I think would matter if this movie had, if the pandemic had been completely avoided, and if this movie had still come out, this would still be an absolute rapturous joy of a film. Yeah, I loved all the characters, I loved all the situations, and again, as a Los Angelino, I love its portrayal of the city, and I think it really has a lot to say, and I think it says it eloquently. So C plus.
I agree. I said this is a very ambitious film. It's first of all, it celebrates poetry.
Yeah.
For God's sake, please more. And it is really trying to. I think this one and Bo Burnham's Inside are really good about capturing a certain ethos of people in their late 20s and early 30s. Yeah. That I think a lot of other films try to dismiss or over romanticize. This is doing it a little bit greater service by turning it into grand art. And I really, really adored this movie.
All right. Sun, the new horror movie on Shudder, without going into great detail about the plot, which I think deserves an unravel on its own, is really quite scary. It's an excellent, scary motion picture. It's definitely, got a lower budget, but it doesn't need more than it has. The cast is excellent. It's a little freak out of a movie, and I highly recommend it, and I hope you check it out. So that's a C+. Fear Street 1978, also a C+. I might even like this one a little bit more than the last. I just think it's incredible. I'm a sucker for this era of slasher movies, and I think they nailed it. Yeah, I really think love this one a lot.
I like it a lot too, and I'm going to give it a C+, although not quite as impassioned as yours. I think I like the first one better.
Fair.
Just because I think it's a little bit more efficient. I think the character work is slightly stronger.
Mm-hmm.
This one sprawls a little bit too much. It sort of takes for granted that we recognize overnight camps from movies of the past rather than kind of establishing its own. That's a bit of an issue,
I think it does a better job than giving credit for it.
But I'm still going to give
it a C+. Yeah, I love it very, very much. And then lastly, Black Widow.
It's a C. I don't hate it. I don't love it. It's just, it doesn't do anything grievously wrong.
Yeah.
It's entertaining enough. I'm not going to give it a C-, but it's definitely not a C+.
I'm torn. I think I'm just going to give it a really high C.
Okay.
I think as an actual just action movie, I think sometimes it's going through the paces. It's not badly handled at all. There's no like one action sequence I could really stand out and go, that one was amazing. And that's a lot of the movie, so I think that's a factor. But what I think rescues it and what I think makes it really, really strong is I think the main characters and their relationships together are really well thought out. I think they elevate a lot of the characters in this whole franchise. I just wanted to spend time with them. I wanted them to deal with their baggage. I appreciated that they didn't just gloss over everything and they actually had them
have serious conversations
about how they've made each other feel. And that's not something you get in action movies a lot. So I appreciated that. I think if the action movie elements had backed up, had been just a little tighter, it would have been a definite C+. But as it stands, it's quite a good Marvel movie. It's an okay action movie. High C from me. And that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. We'll be back next week with a review of...
Well, 1666.
Space Jam.
Oh, God, no.
That's this week, right? I'm not crazy?
Look, Space Jam is coming out on Friday. Look, I would love nothing more than to be really surprised by Space Jam.
Yes. Okay,
Space Jam A New Legacy could be my favorite movie of all time, and I'm open to the idea.
You know what? It's produced by Ryan Coogler. There is a chance.
I did see a clip of Porky Pig rapping, and I'm not hopeful, but...
We've gone on record. We've done a whole podcast about it. We think Space Jam 1, I know a lot of people have a lot of nostalgia for it. We think it's indicative of a lot of really bad things. It represents a lot of bad things that the industry has done.
Pretty awful all around. Yeah. And that it kind of is this whole on tongue kiss with commercialism.
Yeah.
And is not even disguising itself as a film at all. Is a little bit problematic for me.
I think it's significantly problematic. But we'll talk about the original and then hopefully the new one's good. Hey,
yeah, maybe the new one will be good. But we'll be talking about it. And so we'll be talking about the third Fear Street.
And we'll talk about the third Fear Street and there's more stuff coming as well. So we'll talk about that coming up really soon. So thank you everybody for listening. You're all awesome. You're just awesome. And we're super grateful to all of you. We're especially grateful to all of our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We make a whole lot of exclusive podcasts for them, and we have a online hangout coming up in the next week, I think.
That's right.
I don't have my schedule in front of me, but it's coming up real soon. If you want to join up and vote for future episodes of our shows and enjoy exclusive podcasts at every single tier, you can head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. If you can afford that, yeah, I totally get it, man. It's rough out there. But if you want to help the show, please subscribe, leave us a review wherever you find us. It really, really helps a lot.
If you don't have the money to spare, and I understand, the reviews do help a lot. They sort of like push us up on algorithms and let us appear higher on search lists.
Yeah, so people looking for movie reviews, they might actually find the show. And that really does make a difference. So thank you, everybody, who's been doing that. And of course, if you want to join in the conversation, you can email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. And we don't have time to read every single email, but we try. So please, for everyone who sends them in, thank you. And we'll get to them as much as we can. And of course, we're on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I am @WilliamBibiani.
I am @WhitneySeibold.
We just hit a cool milestone at our soap store, 400 sales.
Congratulations.
At our soap store over
Happy
at Etsy. Yeah, it's pretty exciting. So over at our Etsy store, you look for Salt Cat Soap. It's on Twitter and Instagram @SaltCatSoap. And of course, we're on Etsy @SaltCatSoap. We have a lot of designer soaps, mostly designed by M. Lopez de Silva. However, to celebrate the 400th sale, I have brought back one of our best-selling bars, which I actually designed, which is a shave bar, which smells like espresso and honey. And a shave bar is like an actual bar of soap that lathers, so you can use it instead of foam. I know a lot of people have issues with foam. It can be a little abrasive, even at the best of times. I love these shave bars. I think they smell really, really good. I'm actually really proud of how they turned out. So we brought those back. And there's also a sale, 15% off all orders of $10 or more for the rest of the month. So that's all going on over at Salt Cat Soap. Whitney, tell people about P.L. Box and remind them about your other podcast, because we don't do that on
the podcast. That's true. I am co-hosting another podcast, not on this network. It's over on The Screen's Margins, the network founded by B. Peterson. And every week we get together and we talk about what we've watched on Ovid that week. The podcast is currently called All About Ovid, spelled with all O's. O-L-L, About Ovid, O-V-I-D. Ovid is the streaming service where you find a lot of Diaz movies and things that played in museums and like really deep cut art house stuff. It's like if you think the Criterion Channel sold out, man, then Ovid is for you.
What's all this Kurosawa stuff, you poser?
And it's definitely for me and it's definitely for them. B and I talk about on a regular basis. On this last episode, we talked about Genus Pan a little bit, and I also talked about a film called Vampire Clay, which was a film, a Japanese horror film from a couple of years ago about clay that is a vampire.
That sounds awesome. Is it awesome?
It's made by like a special effects technician. It has like Evil Dead level practical effects on it, but it was made just a couple of years ago.
Do I need to check this out? Obviously, I listen to the podcast, but
it's pretty fun. It's not the most profound movie, but it's got some really creative special effects, even some stop motion stuff in there.
I'm stoked.
So yeah, Vampire Clay we talked about that on our last episode. And we're going to do that for as long as we can keep it up. So
that's awesome.
Go over to The Screen's Margins and look for All About Ovid. I think Alonzo Duralde said it was like the least Googleable name of any podcast. So we're trying to think of other names for it.
All right. Well, again, when that happens, we will let you know. And don't forget our P.O. Box.
And our P.O. Box, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California 90064. Mail us something. Mail
us a letter.
If you want.
No pressure. Yeah. We're total soft sell on this, but some people like sending us letters. We've had a few. Gift items, which are very, very nice.
Yeah, thank you for the gifts.
People have asked, and so we want to make sure people have the opportunity to send us stuff if they so choose. That's it. That's it for Critically Acclaimed this week. We'll see you next time, and never forget, everyone's a critic.
I wanna go to the midnight show. I'm sorry. What?